Eugene England is writer in residence and at UVSC, program coordinator for Mormon Cultural Studies at Utah Valley State College. He had a long tenure at Brigham Young University in the English department there. And it's from that experience that he draws upon for his subject this morning, Calculated Risk, the Quest for Freedom and Diversity in Utah Higher Education. He also has a long association with Sunstone the magazine and Sunstone the foundation, beginning with a letter published in Volume 1, Issue 1, Page 5, wishing the enterprise well, and he has been involved in making sure that that happens, currently serving as vice chair for the Sunstone Foundation and on its board of trustees. Brother England.
Thank you, Morgan. At Sunstone, we prefer to refer to the associate chair rather than the vice chair for obvious reasons. Well, thank you for coming so early. I'm always trying to figure out why Elbert always schedules me at 8 o'clock in the morning or 8:45, and I'm not sure whether it's to prevent more people hearing me or in the hope that no reporters will be here to report on what goes on, but let's go for it. For a reason I don't understand, he didn't arrange for anyone to do a rebuttal of me this morning, so you'll get to do that, and we'll be sure to leave you some time for questions. But let me lay out some ideas for you to think about. 40 years ago, in 1960, the institution in Utah higher education with the greatest academic freedom was the University of Utah. 20 years ago, in 1980, the institution in Utah higher education with the greatest academic freedom was, I'm convinced, Brigham Young University. Today, in the year 2000, I believe it is Utah Valley State College. Let me, in the next half hour, see if I can demonstrate these claims, which many of you probably find questionable, if not absurd, especially the last one, that right now, a former trade tech community college in the shadow of BYU, still a two-year college mainly with some four-year programs, but with 20,000 students and growing, might be the place both faculty and students have the greatest opportunity for genuinely free and productive intellectual inquiry. In the 1950s, I majored in English at the University of Utah with a minor in philosophy. There were practicing Mormons in the English, philosophy, art, theater, history, and other departments. Everyone knew they were Mormons and valued them in part for that, for the different intellectual and cultural perspective they brought to all their work, including their work in Mormon cultural studies, which we all knew about. I knew that my fine American literature professor, William Mulder, whom some of you heard yesterday, both wrote about Mormon literature himself and, as editor of Western Humanities Review, published others' scholarly work on Mormon culture. Philosopher Sterling McMurrin, who later served as dean of the graduate school and as U.S. Commissioner of Education, looked closely at the philosophical and theological foundations of the Mormon religion in his classes and later published his ideas in two landmark monographs with those titles. Quite often there were public symposia on matters of Mormon culture. Waldemar Reed, head of the philosophy department, very thoughtfully and respectfully and with telling wit, addressed a packed house on the question, what freedom exists in the local culture? The world-class chemist, Henry Eyring, dean of the graduate school, spoke about Joseph Smith as an intellectual, including a line I still remember. I know Joseph Smith wasn't perfect. For one thing, he was sometimes unkind to Emma. Lowell Binion, beloved LDS writer and teacher and director of the Institute of Religion next to the campus, was much involved in university life, leading special seminars in medical ethics with the med students and seminars in legal ethics with the law students. In June 1956, he was invited by President Ray Alpin to give the baccalaureate address to the graduates and spoke on the dangers of knowledge without love and the great power of intelligent love. In 1962, he left the Institute and was invited by President Alpin to be an associate dean of students with particular concern to counsel Mormon students, and also took a faculty position teaching sociology of religion with it from his particular Mormon perspective. Most of these fairly simple, perhaps obvious things no longer happen at the U. Almost all the Mormon faculty I knew have either left the faith or left the U. And most seriously, they have not been replaced by believing Mormons. Why should they be, you might ask? Isn't this simply a matter of natural attrition, the growing reputation of the U, and its ability to attract first-rate people from all over the world, which is, after all, less than 1% Mormon? Perhaps, but the evidence provided by the way competent Mormon scholars who apply are treated is that it is the result of conscious or unconscious prejudice and exclusion, or at least lack of concern for the educational needs of the students, a majority of whom are Mormon. When I applied for a position in the English department in 1975, I paid a courtesy call to my mentor from the 1950s, the Milton scholar Jack Adamson, by then elevated through department chair to humanities dean to academic vice president. He told me with great pain that as much as he would like to hire me, the English department simply would not approve a devout Mormon, as they knew me to be. I could not believe my ears. Such attitudes at a modern state university seemed to me barbaric and impossible. But in fact, I was not hired, and neither has any other practicing Mormon in 50 years been hired to a tenure-track position in English, or in philosophy in the last 40, or in history for 25 years. An article in last January, in the Salt Lake Tribune, on, quote, anti-Mormonism at the U, based on extensive interviews with more than 40 people, found opinions divided, everyone sure only that it was the touchiest of subjects, some critics unwilling even to give their names for fear of reprisals. The reporter summarized that there are, quote, faculty members who feel disenfranchised because of their affiliation with The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and students who feel pressure to suppress their religious beliefs and backgrounds in the classroom. Mormon faculty talk of being shunned at department meetings, of being kept from influential hiring committees, of seeing excuses dredged up to exclude Mormon scholars from jobs, end of quote. This is from the Tribune, January 9th. One faculty member who did give his name was history professor Bob Goldberg, a Jewish Gentile in Mormon country, who a few years ago spoke out in a public forum against discrimination against Mormons on campus, comparing it to that found at Eastern universities against Jews decades ago, but unthinkable now. In the recent interview, he reported being shocked by the repercussions of his earlier forthrightness. Quote, a variety of people across campus to my face indicated I'd violated the code in regard to the university's dirty laundry and severed their relationships with me, end quote. Thane Robson, director of the U's Bureau of Economic and Business Research, pointed out that since the 1960s, the percent of Mormon faculty has declined from about 80 to less than 10%. In the meantime, the percent of students who are LDS has remained about 70%, and the numbers of highly qualified LDS scholars in the country have greatly increased. Marie Cornwall, a visiting sociology professor, reported people saying, quote, I don't like Mormons, but I like you, and wondered if they would ever say such a thing as, I don't like blacks, but I like you. Of course, University President Bernie Machen denies most of this as folklore, though he does admit that, quote, universities are places where differences are meant to come together and mesh. At the U, it's not working as well as it could, end quote. The reason it's not working well, or very well, I believe, is because most non-Mormons there, and I'm afraid many Mormons as well, do not see those, quote, differences he mentions, particularly the majority Mormon difference, as essential as an educational opportunity. Such diversity could be exploited thoughtfully and openly, precisely in order that one of the major purposes of higher education be fulfilled. In the president's own words, to help, quote, differences come together and mesh. Marie Cornwall's comparison of prejudice against Mormons with prejudice against blacks is perhaps overly dramatic, but helps make a point that the Tribune article and the follow-up editorial and letters have missed. Of course, there is little open sniping at and discrimination against Mormons at the U. It's illegal and uncivil, and the non-Mormon faculty are not barbarians. What the students I talk to experience and feel hurt by, and more important, educationally deprived by, is innuendo, subtle disdain, sometimes mere silence about Mormons and their culture, even when open discussion of Mormon culture would be extremely appropriate and would in fact help the educational process if the teachers would engage that culture respectfully in an academic context. If we were talking about a university that was 70% black or Jewish, the point would be immediately clear. If such a university in the year 2000 did not have courses in black or Jewish culture, literature and history and sociology, etc., most likely taught by black or Jewish scholars, that university would be a laughingstock. In fact, its academic reputation might well be compromised and its accreditation in serious trouble. But even more seriously, it would be failing to seize a great educational opportunity, that is, to engage the majority of its students where they can most directly and easily be reached, that is, in reference to their own culture and belief systems. Such a university would thus neglect material and approaches that could be a great help in achieving perhaps the main purpose of a college education, which is to understand, both critically and appreciatively, the diversity of human cultures, including one's own, even starting with one's own, and thus become a genuine citizen of the national and world community. Mormons are, in important ways, like Jews or Asian Americans or Native Americans, with characteristic and interesting, even richly varied, folklore, customs, cultural history, anthropology, literature, and art. That could be a wonderful resource for teaching the university's Mormon students, and the non-Mormons as well, who are faced with the challenge of living tolerantly in a predominantly Mormon culture and contributing positively to our community life. The important question is not how much overt anti-Mormonism there is at the U. The question is why the president and the administration and faculty are not actively seeking qualified faculty and developing rigorous Mormon cultural study courses and symposia, why they are not seeing the Mormonism of most of their students as an educational opportunity, not merely an unfortunate fact to be disdained or tiptoed around. Wallace Stegner, not a Mormon, but once a student and then professor at the U, produced one of his first books, Mormon Country, which amounted to an in-depth study of the local culture. He later wrote essays in which he decried the fact that most Westerners are educated in a system that ignores their geographical and cultural roots. Many of the current professors at the U, especially in the humanities and social sciences, have been trained to value the diversity and the cultural values, artifacts, and perspectives of their students. And they manifest that in admirable attempts to reach out in curricula, in forums, and symposia, and in hiring to minority Utah cultures like the African American and Hispanic and Native American and Jewish. I would think they might take a cue from Stegner and try to reach out in such ways to the majority of their students as well. When I was turned down by the English department at the U in 1975, I taught LDS Institute for 2 years and then took a position at BYU. My friends, Mormon and non-Mormon, wondered why I would want to teach at a place which was well known for suppressing any kind of student dissent, even long hair and Levi's, and for harassing, even spying on, politically liberal professors in the 1960s. However, my experiences in teaching as a graduate student at the U and at Stanford and then as a professor at the Lutheran St. Olaf College in Minnesota, as well as my interest in the developing field of Mormon literature, convinced me that I might actually be more free at BYU to do the kind of teaching I wanted to do and could do best. And that turned out to be true. I was able to teach and do scholarly criticism in Mormon literature and write and publish personal essays based in Mormon experience. I was able to teach American and British literature with full attention to religious culture and theology that I was convinced informed and illuminated the best work of Chaucer and Shakespeare and Donne and Hawthorne and Dickinson and Milton without either hiding or promoting my own religious experience and perspective. This seemed and still seems a more honest and effective way to teach than any other. Such a personally honest and open approach, along with the freedom to explore a different concept of the good, of what is most valuable than that held generally in secular society, most takes advantage of and maximizes academic freedom and its positive results for the student and for society. I was very fortunate that BYU became progressively more open, more respectful of diversity and freedom from the time I arrived in 1977 on through the 80s. I was able to teach and publish with the freedom I've described, moving more and more in a natural way from mere literary criticism into cultural criticism, published in independent Mormon journals like Dialogue and Sunstone and Exponent 2. I was able to help found and serve as faculty sponsor for a club called Response, which put on symposia each term promoting peace or environmental awareness, sort of a precursor to UVSC's Ethics Center. and I helped found, wrote for, and served as faculty advisor for the independent student newspapers, Seventh East Press and the Student Review. The official student paper, the Daily Universe, invited me to write a series of columns on press and academic freedom, their value to a free society and a religious university, which led to more columns in which I tested those values by writing strong editorials against Mormon cultural racism and militarism, including evidence of those failings at BYU itself. I watched with approval as President Dallin Oaks invited a communist, a member of the Soviet Supreme Court, to speak at BYU and held fast against efforts of conservative Mormons and Mormon leaders to prevent the speech. I saw evidence of the good results of President Jeffrey R. Holland's delegation of much power and decision-making down the line to faculty and students. And as head of the hiring committee, I worked with English Department Chair Bert Wilson as he gained administrative approval, specific administrative approval, and then hired outstanding young feminist and postmodern scholars to help prepare our English Department graduates for the top-flight graduate schools. By the late 80s, BYU was experiencing a kind of golden age, with a relatively high degree of academic freedom and growing appreciation of the diversity of cultural perspective, though there were a few small clouds on the horizon. The culture wars in the national culture between conservatives and liberals, traditionalists and innovators, began to divide academic departments at other American universities and finally began to affect BYU in the late 80s, where the divisions were heightened because some traditionalists declared that God and official church doctrine were on their side, and some innovators felt they had some kind of divine mission to, quote, liberate their students from traditional Mormon thinking. Now, only 10 years later, many of the more liberal faculty, especially in the English department, have been fired or left or become silent. The independent student newspapers have been destroyed or reduced to marginal existence by policies against distribution on campus and by harassment or even punishment of faculty and students for their writings in them. The official student paper is so firmly under administrative control that it gets in trouble and has to publicly apologize for even reporting controversial statements by campus speakers. The Response Club and its spin-off Eco-Response are defunct, and the only remotely activist club, Voice, BYU's Committee to Promote the Status of Women, as well as its faculty advisors, has been under regular harassment. Faculty hiring and tenuring is conducted within the limits of an administration-controlled screen that demands a narrow political and cultural correctness. There is almost no effort to promote, through visiting lectures or public symposia, what would be the chief evidence for academic freedom. Civil discourse about a variety of viewpoints or controversial issues in any way threatening to a very narrow view of Mormon cultural orthodoxy. Tenured as well as untenured and part-time faculty are subject to outright dismissal or extreme pressure to leave without peer review of the accusations against them or opportunity to face their accusers. And perhaps worst of all, an increasing number of students, as well as a few reactionary faculty who encourage them, have picked up these signals. They assert their right not to read or discuss anything they disagree with or feel threatened by culturally, and even see themselves as vigilantes responsible to check out professors' orthodoxy and report it to higher authority. Let me read something I'd thought I might leave out, but I think we've got time, about faculty attitudes and the dangers I see in a growing faculty passivity and cultural correctness. Most of the BYU faculty, as indicated in two recent surveys, one by a BYU graduate student, Paul Rose, and another based on the one developed by Michael Beatty and Larry Lyon at Baylor University, report themselves happy with the current situation and are not open to forums or voices that might convince them otherwise. In the BYU version of the Baylor survey, administered in 1998 and reported in the fall 1999 BYU Studies, a majority of the faculty agreed that, quote, during the last decade, the emphasis shifted away from greater academic freedom, quote, towards greater commitment to faith. And 75% found that approach, quote, about right. In Paul Rose's survey, conducted about the same time and reported in the spring 1999 Dialogue, a large majority of faculty reported themselves happy with BYU, its degree of academic freedom, and its hiring and tenuring procedures. However, nearly a fourth of the faculty disagree that BYU is a place where they, quote, have the freedom to discuss and advocate controversial and unpopular ideas. And some added comments like, no, and that is good, or why should it? A crucial confusion was revealed in response to two questions. Two-thirds of the respondents disagreed that the ban in BYU's official academic freedom document against, quote, expression that contradicts or opposes rather than analyzes or discusses fundamental church doctrine or policy clearly delineates what professors at BYU may or may not express. In other words, the official statement about what's off limits was not clear to them. It didn't define clearly what they couldn't do. And about the same percent agreed that, quote, BYU professors should not conduct even sound research that may draw into question church or university procedures, end quote. In other words, if most faculty feel, based on the administration's official statements about the recent firings and other matters, as well as its own actions, that it is not clear what the limits on freedom are, and whether their research or opinions about Mormon culture could possibly be seen as wrong or dangerous, then extreme caution, even avoidance of Mormon studies strategy, and that's exactly what's happening. In my experience, that self-censorship is widespread and based on serious confusion between official doctrine and cultural correctness. And the need to sort out the difference is neglected because the atmosphere of cultural correctness prevents open discussion of the very difference itself. Let me go on then with my regular paper. The key element in this change, I believe, was the decision by administrators beginning in about 1990 to take sides in the academic version of the culture wars. There had been growing tensions in humanities and social science departments all across the country between traditional, more politically conservative scholars and the new historicists, feminists, and postmodernists, many of them political and cultural liberals. This kind of challenge to the old by the new is common in academic life, and usually, if conducted professionally by the academics themselves, results in compromise or mutual tolerance or a gradual paradigm shift to a new academic orthodoxy. It is the common way academic fields develop. But in this case, some extremely conservative administrators were sympathetic to, some even participating in, the national right-wing attack on the new literary and cultural theories as not only wrong but evil. They were not willing to trust the academic search for truth and use their power to support the most vocal traditionalists and to harass and even purge the advocates of the new ideas. As a result, what academic freedom still exists at BYU is mainly that given to the traditionalists to advocate their views and to defame and report on their liberal colleagues without restraint. And I must say that maintained by the courage and determination of a very few individual faculty in their classrooms and a few who make energetic and thoughtful efforts, including planning faculty seminars, as philosophy professor Jim Faulkner has done, on such things as feminism and postmodernism, to maintain some healthy civil dialogue. In my opinion, the shift to less academic freedom at BYU has not been necessary for the survival of BYU's unique religious mission and its valuable contribution to the diversity of our society's thinking about what is good. It is rather, I believe, the result of a fearful and unnecessary overreaction to the supposed threats of secularization and liberalization posed by the new intellectual and political forces in our national culture. These forces are certainly challenging to American and to Utah culture. They call for greater respect for diversity than Americans, including Utahns, have shown in the past, and for greater humility about the sources of truth and the reliability of traditional means for expression of it. But these forces could have been met with reasoned argument. Instead, many at BYU seem to me defeated by the culture wars, willing to accept a standard of cultural correctness that has little to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ. For whatever reason, it seems the BYU administration and most of the faculty no longer believe in the fundamental rationale for academic freedom, that it is a calculated risk by a society or an individual that is always costly but has constantly proven itself of enormous value for the improvement of society and the salvation of persons. Society has always imposed limits on the freedom of academics. Socrates chose to drink hemlock because civil authorities thought his efforts to teach the youth of Athens to think for themselves was corrupting them, especially their religious orthodoxy. Today, there are pressures toward political correctness and banning of what is called hate speech. And quite certainly, there will always be bans on openly inflammatory rhetoric, crying fire in a crowded theater, and on libel, defamation, and speech that advocates destruction of the very institutions that protect free speech, whether our American democracy or the university itself. But there's also a long, honorable tradition of efforts to achieve and maximize and defend the unusual freedom of teachers and students to speak and write and learn, no matter how offensive the expressions and ideas are to the administration or the society. Our modern ideas of academic and freedom in America were most influenced by the German system of the late 19th century, which was so successful in the search for new truth that it attracted thousands of students from America. They returned strongly committed to the concepts of the freedom of the professor to teach and write without external controls, either religious or governmental, and also the freedom of the students to choose their own courses and learn what they would. Of course, there were some limits in the German schools. No atheist could teach religion, or anarchist could teach political science, and the freedom was only internal, within the confines of the university and within the area of the professor's training, not for public advocacy on social issues. The limits that developed in America were unexpected. As church-controlled institutions became more secular and chose governing boards of lay people concerned with the college's financial security and often themselves rich and part of the industrial elite, those boards dismissed faculty not for religious unorthodoxy, but for their liberal economic and political teachings. A number of cases of faculty firings or pressure to recant at the University of Wisconsin, Cornell, the University of Chicago, and perhaps most famously Stanford, where a respected economist, E.A. Ross, was fired and seven professors resigned in protest, led to the formation of the American Association of University Professors in 1915. With greatly respected academics like John Dewey and A.O. Lovejoy in charge, nearly 900 professors met at Johns Hopkins University, focused on protection of jobs through tenure, asserted that their major responsibility was to society and not to their governing boards, and issued a declaration of principles that defined academic freedom for the first time and soon gained it legal recognition. The entire emphasis was on the professor's freedom, not the students. But the basic ideal for both was clear in this formulation by Professor Lovejoy. Quote, academic freedom is the freedom of a teacher or researcher in higher institutions of learning to investigate and discuss the problems of their science and to express their conclusions without interference from political or ecclesiastical authority or from the administration, unless his methods are found by qualified bodies of his own profession to be clearly incompetent or contrary to professional ethics. End quote. But the AUP accommodated to societal pressures during World War I when it failed to protect professors who spoke out against the war, and during the Depression when it failed to take a stand against teacher oath pledges designed to limit academic freedom in the name of social stability. This and its failure to come up with a set of rules for difficult cases led to a new statement of principles on academic freedom and tenure in 1940. This was accepted by the Association of American Colleges and remains the basic document for guiding higher education in America. The statement was sorely tested in the McCarthyite 50s. The paranoia about the advances of world communism and Soviet power led to dismissal of many professors because they were suspected communists or merely unfriendly witnesses before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And there was very little courageous or principled opposition from either college administrators or the AAUP. In the 60s and 70s, the threats to academic freedom often came from the left rather than the right. Students who were caught up in the passions of the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements and made radical critiques of universities themselves as hosts of racism and militarism and general repression engaged in disruptive, even violent activities that prevented debate or even civil discourse and limited the freedom of both professors and other students. I was part of those movements and quite critical of the complicity and lack of self-criticism characteristic of higher education. But one morning in 1970, after the Kent State killings, I arrived at my class at what is now California State University at Hayward to find the doors blocked by a student strike. The students, knowing my sympathy with their basic criticism of the war and higher education, invited me to speak at their rally that afternoon. I did so and gave them lecture they weren't expecting and were mostly not happy to hear. I spoke on the necessity of preserving and keeping open the universities as the host of academic freedom. If any of the improvements in society they were fighting for were to occur. In other words, the right to oppose war and racism and university action and policy. It was right of them to oppose war and racism and university action and policies, but wrong to silence people who disagreed, or especially to shut down the universities. I continue to believe that strongly. Academic freedom is not an inherent right, nor a basic constitutional right protected under the First Amendment. It is a calculated risk, a privilege granted by society, which pays the taxes and gives the contributions which make possible our very expensive higher educational system. It is a risk taken because society has come to accept that academic freedom serves the long-term best interests of society. Both academic freedom and tenure have been recognized by most thinkers to have serious disadvantages, but most also believe the benefits accrued to society are well worth those disadvantages. It is a calculated risk and always fragile, in danger of being misused or diminished. What are the advantages that justify those risks? What are the services rendered to society and to civilization itself that are so valuable? They are worth the potential costs in faculty arrogance and abuse of their powers of corrupting the youth, of outright offense to the community's common wisdom and the majority's moral perspective. Why would a society pay the costs and lend its trust to a process of free inquiry wherever it leads? Most thoughtful people and leaders in our society have come to believe that what is called useless basic research, that is, pursued for its own sake, unconnected to any apparent practical benefits for society, actually provides the foundation for all beneficial progress, in the sciences especially. By the same token, we have learned that the independent search for truth and understanding makes possible the diversity of research and thought and opinion upon which our free society depends for some of its finest qualities and advancements. Most of us are convinced it is no accident that the societies that have supported disinterested basic research and free inquiry have been both those that are most productive of new technology, great art, and literature, but also those that are most politically free have found the best long-term solutions to social problems. The Supreme Court, in a 1957 case overturning a contempt conviction of a professor for refusing to testify before the McCarthy Committee on the content of his lecture, stated the value of academic freedom this way, quote, "No one should underestimate the vital role in a democracy that is played by those who guide and train our youth. To impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would imperil the future of our nation. Scholarship cannot flourish in an atmosphere of suspicion and distrust. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die." End quote. The best case for both academic and other kinds of freedom of expression was made in 1939, when indeed Western civilization was in severe peril. Walter Lippmann, in a famous essay in the Atlantic Monthly called The Indispensable Opposition, argued that there was a most significant difference between democracies like England and the United States and the dictatorships that were threatening to destroy them. In democracies, the political opposition is paid out of the public treasury because we know we need to hear their opinions in order to improve our own. On the contrary, despots kill or imprison the opposition and thus shut themselves off from the truth they cannot succeed without. And so dictatorships decline and fail. His basic point is that we do not support free speech and inquiry and open debate in order to be nice, to be merely tolerant, as a kind of luxury, but rather as an essential need. Quote, "We must protect the right of our opponents to speak because we must hear what they have to say. Because freedom of discussion improves our own opinions. The liberties of others are our own vital necessity. Freedom of speech may not produce the truth, or the whole truth all the time, or often, or in some cases ever. But if truth can be found, there is no other system which will normally and habitually find so much truth, end quote. In other words, academic freedom is a calculated risk, but one that has proven well worth the risk. Instead of defensively quibbling over its alleged anti-Mormonism, the University of Utah could embrace opportunities to hire Mormon professors and engage in studies of Mormon culture that include open debate and intellectual give and take, not to be nice or to win the financial support of the Mormon legislature, but because that would improve the diversity and quality of debate and of the search for truth to the benefit of all faculty and students of the university and of Utah civilization. Similarly, instead of restricting its hiring and retention of faculty to those with a conservative cultural perspective and its forums and public lectures to Mormons and non-Mormons of similar perspective, BYU could broaden its gates to the many devout Mormons and other good people with more moderate perspectives, not to be tolerant or keep the ACLU or the AAUP off its back, but because that would allow the expression and response and correction of ideas, the give and take, that can improve the quality of the Utah and, yes, the Mormon culture as a whole. Such indispensable freedom, Lippman argues, must not be mere tolerance, certainly not free license, but rather respectful engagement. Simply allowing various voices to speak in isolation will not work. Quote, freedom of speech is established to achieve its essential purpose only when different opinions are expounded in the same hall to the same audience, such as we are doing today at Sunstone. And let me just interrupt to praise Sunstone for being uniquely the kind of open forum that I'm talking about in Mormon culture. And I think proving itself over time worth the calculated risk. Some of you heard Elbert speak yesterday about an open forum. And to demonstrate in that process the personal values, Elbert has become a greater person, a finer person, a more sensitive and responsive and vulnerable, graceful person, because he has been true to the ideal of listening to others who disagree with him. And his great ideal for us is that we be that kind of forum. In the first part of the 20th century, most references to academic freedom were assumed to mean professors' freedom to teach. But in the 60s and 70s, concern grew about the students' freedom to learn. Many students who were working for various rights causes began to question whether students had rights that were being ignored in the hierarchical authoritative college structure and classroom. On the other hand, many of those same students seemed willing to interfere with other students' right to learn when they disrupted classes and lectures, intimidated speakers they disagreed with, and even shut down whole universities in self-righteous zeal for their own political crusade. Some of their professors joined with them or sympathized enough with their leftist causes that they were not energetic in protecting the rights of the faculty and speakers and students they themselves disagreed with. By the same token, in the 80s, according to educational philosopher Daniel Bell, the main challenge to academic freedom was conservative Republicans, joined and energized by evangelical Christians in the so-called moral majority, who conducted a national revolt against modernity and what they saw as a trend toward secularism throughout our culture. In the resulting culture wars, as I saw at BYU, conservative academics and their students were not interested in protecting the academic freedom of those they disagreed with and tended to think of as dangerous to the American Christian way of life, even as tools of the devil. The failure on the part of my more conservative Mormon colleagues at BYU was and is particularly disheartening to me. It shows, despite their claim to be professional academics, an unwillingness to take the calculated risk of academic freedom for the social and intellectual gains that have been well proven over time. It also betrays, despite their claim to be Orthodox Mormons, an unwillingness to take the calculated risk of free exploration and expression, which Mormon theology itself claims is necessary for individual salvation, and which has existed even at the highest levels in earlier times. Besides the social reasons for wanting freedom, most human beings have basic beliefs that encourage free choice and expression as crucial to our individual worth and development. Many find free choice the definitive human quality, to be protected at all costs. For some, the ground of their respect for freedom is in their concept of a freely loving and creative divinity. For Mormons, their basic beliefs posit that each individual has existed forever, uncreated by God, with an essential capacity and need to grow toward godhood through free exercise of choice or agency in an atmosphere where many choices, including good and evil, are available in opposition. The very choice to come to earth involved the calculated risk to go into such a dangerous environment, because that was the only one that allowed the opportunity for growth and salvation. The history of moral development on this earth begins with Adam and Eve, choosing to risk knowing good and evil rather than to remain in ignorant innocence and thus unable to progress. And Mormons are taught in the temple that each of us must figuratively become an Adam or an Eve and make that same choice. As Brigham Young put it, every mortal being must stand up as an intelligent, organized capacity and choose or refuse the good and thus act for himself. All must have that opportunity, no matter if all go into the depths of darkness and wickedness. End quote. And he saw education with a full range of free inquiry as crucial to that process. Quote, we must learn the nature of mankind and to discern the divinity inherent in them. We should not only study good and its effect upon our race, but also evil and its consequences. President Hugh B. Brown gave specific application of those principles to BYU with a speech there in 1967. Quote, preserve then the freedom of your mind in education and in religion, and be unafraid to express your thoughts and to insist upon your right to examine every proposition. End quote. Speaking for the First Presidency, he said, quote, we are not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox as we are that you shall have thoughts. One of the most important things in the world is freedom of the mind. From this, all other freedoms spring. Such freedom is necessarily dangerous, for one cannot think right without running the risk of thinking wrong. But generally, more thinking is the antidote for the evils that spring from wrong thinking. More thinking is required, and we call upon you students to exercise your God-given right to think through on every proposition that is submitted to you and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings. Sounds like a good mission statement for Sunstone. If that is, as I believe it is, an accurate statement of the official Mormon position on academic freedom, then the place we can hope for Mormons in the year 2000 to expect to find the greatest academic freedom is at Utah Valley State College. And that is because UVSC is most willing to take the large calculated risk, at least in Utah. It is trying to combine what, as we have seen, are often thought to be at odds, traditional secular standards for academic freedom, together with a serious attempt to be friendly to the needs and perspectives of its large religious majority, which is the same majority as exists in the local society that sustains that college. This makes UVSC perhaps unique in the world, certainly in relation to Mormonism. I have outlined, as available at UVSC, the great potential benefits of this calculated risk: a nearly unlimited academic freedom that can nurture imaginative research and expression and open inquiry of the kind that we know will make our community, our nation, and our civilization better. What are the potential costs? What is the Scylla and Charybdis, the narrow passage between rocks and whirlpool that we must navigate? On the one hand are the austere cliffs of secular disdain for all religion, or at least for a majority religion that is unavoidably prominent in the Utah community and can at least appear to be repressive, and therefore reaction against any of its cultural manifestations, good or bad. It is the whirlpool of cultural correctness, the inability of the religious majority to make some separation of its cultural expression from its core doctrines, and thus its tendency to feel attacked when it is studied or examined objectively, as it must be if it is to receive the proven benefits of academic freedom. We talked about some of these dangers yesterday as we outlined our plans and our hopes for our program in Mormon Cultural Studies at UVSC, which we're inaugurating with a grant from NEH, which just came through this week. We will be testing that this year. We'll find out. We'll do Mormon Cultural Studies, learn how to do it, and find out what some of the benefits and the perils are. And we hope you'll join us. Come to our conferences and our lectures, read our publications as we try seriously and in a free atmosphere to study our culture in order to understand it and improve it. I think maybe I'll skip the last part of my talk, so we'll have some time for questions. Let me just end with a kind of peroration to students, since all of you are students. What is the student's obligation as we walk this narrow road toward better education? It is to grow up, to assume that college will challenge their thinking and cause them to reassess their cultural values, because that is precisely what higher education is for. It is to move us from being provincial to being citizens of the world. We all grow up in provinces with our own beliefs and culture. We must learn that there are other beliefs and cultures, reexamine our own in the light of them, and come to be able both to appreciate and to criticize those cultural differences so that we can live in a diverse world with both firm beliefs and with values of our own and with genuine thoughtful respect for those of others and for those others as part of our common human family. As students, we should seek out people who are different from us and think differently, not so we can be like them, but so we can respect, even love them in our differences and understand our own values better. Otherwise, our world and even our Utah society are condemned to continue in prejudice and discrimination and even violence. As students, we must never say, as a student said to me a year ago as she dropped my class, "You ask ideas that I disagreed with, and I never want to do that." Mormon students need to remember Walter Lippmann's point about the indispensable opposition and actively seek the new and even opposing ideas that will help them improve their own ideas and thus their contributions to society and civilization. They need to remember Brigham Young's point about learning by their experience in real confrontation with a range of opinions and values in order that they can tell good from evil and thus work out their own salvation. Mormon students also need to take to heart a scripture from the Doctrine and Covenants, section 42, verse 88, the one in which the Lord Jesus Christ, repeating the counsel he gave while on the earth, recorded in the book of Matthew, commanded us when we are offended to talk first and privately with the one who has offended us in order to be reconciled and not to go first to others or to the public with our complaints. I am convinced that many of the destructive controversies played out in the press in recent months over ethics classes at UVSC and allegations of English teachers indoctrinating their students could have been avoided if the offended parties had gone in private to those who offended them or that they disagreed with and talked things out. This, of course, assumes a willingness on both sides to work things out, not the assumption we too often make that those who offend us or criticize us are out to destroy us, even part of a conspiracy. And this obligation of not escalating differences, of being genuine peacemakers, applies to both students and faculty. I go on to talk a little about the characteristics of Utah Valley. It's quite extreme cultural conservatism, the values, and the difficulties that will pose for us as we work through what we want to do there that we think can be both culturally and academically enlightening. Let me just end with this charge that is made by a church leader. 2 years ago in General Conference, Elder Richard G. Scott of the LDS Quorum of 12 Apostles pointed out that in every culture, there are beliefs and practices that are inconsistent with the gospel of Christ. He gave some examples, the caste system in India, and the machismo denigration of women in some Latin American cultures. And he urged Mormons, including himself, each to examine carefully their own culture, their traditions, and make changes where needed. One great function of higher education in Utah, possible only if there is great academic freedom, is to help us make that examination. To study, even criticize our own culture and inherited traditions, is not to criticize the church or its leaders, but to prepare to live better the high ideals they and the gospel of Christ have set for us. The University of Utah presently neglects this opportunity because it does not take Mormon culture seriously as an object of study and discourse. Such cultural study has declined at BYU because of the present, I hope temporary, pressures toward a narrow cultural correctness that is confused with Mormon orthodoxy, which is actually much broader than that, including both conservative and liberal elements. Such an opportunity for free and open cultural study is growing at UVSC because it values both Mormon culture and academic freedom and is creating a climate where free inquiry, respectful appreciation, and criticism can open and train young minds for lifelong learning and discovery and for improving and enriching our community life. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes for questions. Go ahead, brother.
I'm Omar Timothy from the University of Equal Recommend Requirements.
Well, I've been away for 2 years. I don't know all the problems that BYU is having. The interesting thing is that they're even considering non-Mormons because the message has come through very clearly over the last 10 years that we should hire only Mormons. And maybe to avoid that problem in part, and it's only in areas where there just simply is no Mormon qualified to fill a position, and this may be true in certain engineering areas, are they even free to consider Mormons. The interesting twist on this that I find is that the Mormons we already have at BYU, we have one in our department, a fine Catholic scholar, are actually the ones now who are most comfortable at BYU. For the ironic reason that they don't care about Mormon culture. In other words, they are not interested in doing what we often say in our discussions at BYU and in our official pronouncements, is our purpose, which is to combine our faith with our academic field. And it's the Mormons who actually do that that get in the most trouble, because if you do that with freedom, you will occasionally find problems. You will come up with conclusions that someone will think are inappropriate for our conservative culture. So it's actually the Mormons on the faculty who are willing to do what the university has called them to do, engage in genuine study of Mormon culture, who have been most uncomfortable. And the non-Mormons have generally been fairly happy there, unless, as you pointed out, they feel constrained by that particular restraint. And the ones who are there don't feel constrained by that. They realize that's a price they have to pay, and they value, as they should, many wonderful things about BYU. It's a very clean campus. It's a very supportive campus in terms of physical facilities, money for research. I was wonderfully treated in all of those areas. The problems I'm talking about have to do with the kind of thing that I think would mainly affect a Mormon seriously interested in using his academic freedom to understand and improve his own culture. Well, I think I indicated at one point, has been my greatest worry, that students are picking up these signals. The worst version of it is those who are turning into vigilantes, who see their function in class to check on the cultural correctness of the professor and if they're out of line to report it. That seems to me the absolutely worst kind of situation for a student to be in, to be in a class for that purpose. No, not only are they not learning, they're learning something very unethical, I think. And that, I've noticed over the past few years, has increased. On the other hand, there are always and increasingly good students. BYU's increasing pool of applicants and higher standards academically is producing better and better students in terms of their intellectual capacity and very often their intellectual curiosity. So I'm sure they're feeling some tensions, and some of them express those to me. And there are professors who are able in their classes to find ways to help them develop. I was just really recently impressed with the seminar that Richard Bushman runs every summer at BYU, where about 7 or 8 students are chosen, LDS from across the country, to come there and study with him in background for the book he's writing, the second volume of his biography of Joseph Smith. And as I went to those seminars, the interesting thing, which I had never really seen before in an academic situation, is that the students were much more daring and incisive and critical in the normal academic sense than the professors who were there. I think that's an interesting indication of a mood that's taken over BYU and new minds and voices coming in, not accustomed to that, act like they're in a real academic setting. Richard has been very encouraging of that, and so that may be one of the freest things that goes on at BYU. But that was very encouraging, to meet young Mormon scholars who are devoted to the church and to their standards, but genuinely free in their inquiry and studying Joseph Smith in that spirit. So I hope it doesn't sound as hopeless as my paper may. There are young Mormon students at BYU, certainly faculty, are continuing this tradition, which is, I think, the mainstream Mormon tradition. I hope we're on a little byroad here, that some people talk about pendulum swings and phases that institutions go through, and maybe if you have a long enough view, you can be optimistic. Yes, right here on the aisle. Well, that's been a serious question for me. Twice I've been there when accreditation teams were there and visited with them and talked about these problems, and they sympathized and then gave affirmative reports. I think it's very difficult when a university has a long tradition of accreditation and has prestigious programs to challenge that on grounds that are somewhat vague, and especially a religious and private institution. You may know that the AUP actually, though, recently censored BYU, came and did a study that's not accreditation, but it's related to this very issue, and made a fairly severe censure of BYU for these very reasons. It seems to have had no effect. BYU dismissed this, published a list of prestigious universities that had been censured in the past, and prided itself on being part of that group, which seemed to me a strange kind of response, but rather than addressing the very real problems, which I think in the surveys, even though the surveys show that, in fact, as you might expect, a large majority of BYU faculty are quite happy with things, that there are problems, including confusion about what the standards are. Yes, right in front of you. Stand up and speak loud.
My name is Adam Blackwell. I'm actually a person to come from.
Well, the best analysis I've seen of this, and I recommend it strongly to you, is Brian Waterman's book, The Lord's University, kind of giving the history of the last 15 or 20 years, picking up from Gary Bergera's and Ron Prittis' fine book, History of BYU. He, in his last chapter, traces what he sees as the main influence, and that is the bringing of the culture wars into BYU and the administration taking sides, in something that administration should never do in academic areas, and therefore authenticating and validating a particular cultural perspective over against another that should have been worked out at the academic level, and I think could have been rather peacefully. In regard to your other question about what is happening to our culture in terms of its valuing of the intellectual and the faithful, this is one of those great contraries that I think Joseph Smith was talking about when, near the end of his life, he said, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest." When I grew up, those were seen as two valid and equally valuable resources God has given us to understand our lives, to find truth, and to live. What has happened very clearly, and it's apparent in this survey with specific questions that reveal this, that there's been a gradual trend at BYU away from valuing the intellect and the spirit and those as approaches to truth equally, as I think the scriptures clearly do. What do they say? Seek learning by study and also by faith. If anything, it values study more than faith in terms of preeminence there. But clearly, the faculty has come to feel more and more and to agree with statements in the survey that suggest that, and even though President Kimball, as recently as 1975, talked about being bilingual, having both sets of languages and qualities and attitudes of the scholarly discipline and of the kingdom, and others have talked about those things since then, clearly we have moved at BYU and generally in our culture to a sense that if there's any conflict or even generally, we will value faith over reason. I think that's inconsistent with mainstream Mormonism and a serious cultural departure from the great strength of Mormon theology, which sees our minds and our bodies as divine and as God-given gifts, part of our eternal equipment, not to be denigrated, but to be valued. And it's resulted in some very strange kinds of attitudes, ideas, and especially the danger of the use of the trump card. Let me just read this last little part. Maybe that's a good point to end on. Truth claims, hypotheses can come from anywhere. New observations, imaginative thinking, mystical visions, or, and I firmly believe it is a primary source and should be at BYU, inspiration and revelation, insights that come only through faith. But those hypotheses, to be of value in a university setting, must be tested by evidence and argument and communicated in rational ways that can be persuasive to other rational human beings. I think that's ground zero. You cannot use faith to bludgeon people. You've got to convince them, and that's essentially a rational process. Exalting revelation over reason as a means of proof rather than as a source of ideas and values tends to encourage people to use it as a trump card against the evidence. And I've heard this at BYU. If you had the Holy Ghost, as I do, you'd know I'm right. The great sermon on faith by the Book of Mormon prophet Alma clearly taught that faith in God's revelations was the proper source of great and crucial ideas that we would never otherwise consider. I think BYU is right to insist on that, that it's a unique university where those ideas are available in a way that might not be available anyplace else, those ideas of good. And those should be preserved as a contribution to American society as a whole. But those ideas, such as the very existence of God and salvation from sin through Jesus Christ, but when it comes to proving those ideas, he insisted, Alma in the Book of Mormon, that we must, quote, awake and arouse our faculties. I thought that might apply to BYU sometime. Even to an experiment in which we try out the new idea that came by faith and see if there is clear evidence that proves itself experientially and enlightens our rational understanding. BYU certainly has the right to take a course in which the trump card of irrational faith takes precedence over the traditionally and quite universally accepted standards of evidence through which humans test and argue and convince each other. But it remains a serious question whether it can then rightly call itself a university, with all that name implies about academic freedom and reasoned discourse, and claim the corresponding status and rights in the larger American community. It is an even more serious question for me, speaking now as a committed practicing Mormon, whether BYU needs to take the course to preserve its very valuable mission, which is to teach with academic excellence in an environment of faith and building of moral character. I think the tragedy of the last 10 or 15 years is that this move has been advanced by some as necessary to preserve BYU's unique identity. I don't think that's true at all. I think the commitment of its faculty and its students and its governing board would assure that BYU would not become secularized. Let me end by reading a statement by President Hinckley that I think BYU, in a sense, has violated. He came there in 1992 and made this statement, which I think is true, but we have acted as if it were not true, with the suspicion and the restraints that has been exercised upon the faculty. He said, October 13, 1992, I am confident that never in the history of BYU has there been a faculty better qualified professionally nor more loyal and dedicated to the standards of the church. I think that was true in 1992, and it was unnecessary to try to contain those few voices that were at least calmly asking for reconsideration of some basic ideas. Thank you. Our time is up.